America has 2.2 million people in prison. If just 1% is wrong, that's 22,000 people. That's a lot of people's lives destroyed.
If the system wants to take you out of society, they will do it. No matter what laws they have to break, saying that they are enforcing the laws, but they're breaking the law.
Having to hear those people say that I was guilty of a crime that I did not commit, and then hear my family break down behind me and not be able to do anything about it, I can't describe the crushing weight that was.
I'm not anti-police, I'm just anti-corruption.
A lot of times we look and we see something happen to somebody, and that's the first thing we say, that could never happen to me, but it can.
This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Today's guest is the one and only Rodney Roberts.
Rodney Roberts was held for 17 years for the crime of raping a 17-year-old girl he had never met. Rodney was advised by his public defender to plead guilty. He was told that the 17-year-old girl was right outside the courtroom, had identified him, and if he did not plead guilty, he was going to spend the rest of his life in jail.
Rodney Roberts' story. A guilty plea born of fear, a maxed out sentence of 7 years, and on the day of release, not a ride home, but a surprise transfer to civil commitment. It's a kind of imprisonment reserved for just one type of offender. It has no set sentence and no guarantee of release, because the state deems them too dangerous to release. And the state says it's a treatment program, but the residents call it prison. He would be held there as an incorrigible, violent sex offender for a full decade, although it would later be proven that he had been innocent from the start.
Rodney was finally released after 17 years because he got a lawyer who had DNA evidence.
Rodney, welcome to the show. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, Rodney, this whole crazy saga of your life started when you were 17, really, right?
Yes.
And up until then, your life had been what? Peaceful, good, troubled? What was your background?
Actually, up until then, my life was very well. I had both parents, mother and father, in the household, work. My mother, she was hands-on. She has a master's degree in education. She believed in education and us learning. I have six sisters and four brothers, so we had a full house.
That's a whole football team.
I mean, yeah. I was never alone. I was always well-supervised. I had no trouble as a juvenile, no juvenile incarceration, or no trouble in that level. I was very good student. You know, we went to private school from first to eighth grade. So my life then was very positive. If I was poor, I wasn't even aware of it because I was so well cared for by my parents and my older brothers and sisters and my aunts and my uncles and the people in the community. You know, back then at that time, you know, you had like five, six mothers in the neighborhood. You were watched by so many others that you could be disciplined by the lady down the street and she'd bring you to your mother and then get disciplined right in front of her by your mother. So it was a different time then. And the love in the community and the household was very strong.
And which neighborhood was this?
Well, originally we grew up in the project area on Montgomery Street, you know, which, again, was different at that time. And then we moved to a one-family house up in the Vellsburg area. That's in Newark, New Jersey, right across the street from Vellsburg Park. So I can run off my front porch right into a park.
So you grew up in Newark, New Jersey.
Yes, I grew up in Newark.
And it sounds really very sort of beautiful in a certain way, very community-oriented, right. Nice, like you said, a huge family and a huge extended family.
Yeah.
And this is why when I tell people, if you don't think this can happen to you, this can happen to you.
Yeah.
Because you didn't just paint a likely scenario for someone who's going to end up really getting wrongfully convicted twice.
Right.
And serving over two decades in prison.
Right.
For crimes you didn't commit. So let's get into that part of the story. Because when you were a kid, you were kind of hanging out with older guys, right?
Right.
And then you kind of got blindsided because you weren't really aware of what these guys were up to.
Right. I mean, the blindsidedness particularly came from the fact that I grew up in so much of a, what people call now, a sheltered household, sheltered life, that a lot of things going on the streets I really wasn't exposed to. So Me growing up, I would have to come in the house early and things of that nature. I thought I was missing out on a lot of things. So I would find little ways to sneak out the house, not really knowing what I was getting myself into. And because of that, I wasn't aware of what was out there. I was more easy to be manipulated in that environment. I was smart, but I was stupid at the same time.
Well, I wouldn't say stupid, naive.
That's a good word. Yeah. Naive is a much better word. I like that word better than stupid, too. So, like, the older guys in the community who so much, like, see young guys, they see potential in, but they seen the potential in a different way. They seen the potential in, like, a more negative way. How could I sharpen this guy up to help me commit my crimes and help me get over? And I became under that radar. And when they approached me like, hey, man, we like the way you blend right in. We just want you to do this. Just look, be a scout, be a lookout. Just do this and do minimal things, things that I thought was really cool. You know, hey, I'm in now. You know, I'm part of the streets now. Thinking that I was going to earn a street cred all the time, I was being played. Because of my naiveness or my naivete, I wasn't able to see what was really going on with me.
But when you're a kid, with that kind of flattery, when an older person shows you respect and treats you as their equal, that can be very intoxicating and can lead you down a road that you don't really know you're going because you're blinded, right? Because you're thinking that you're in with the cool squad or whatever. So what happened?
Well, what happened was, first, I hid this from my family. I wanted to add that part. They didn't know what was going on, so I separated myself from my protection. And that was a key point. And that point where this particular day, we were out and they were saying, well, what's going on out here on the avenue, which is Tacoma Avenue in Newark. It was a busy street, very crime-orientated. And I came back and said, well, this person is doing this, and this person is doing that, and that person is stopping, picking up this. And so in that course, they took action from there. And they went into and committed the crimes that they committed in detail, which was robberies, kidnapping, sexual-related offenses. And me, because I played my role, I was charged as a conspirator. Not that I committed any offenses, but because I acted in the capacity I acted in at that age, I was also charged. I went to trial with these individuals and was found guilty with these individuals and had to serve 5 years alongside these individuals as a conspirator. And my record reflected the same as theirs, even though I did not participate. But as a conspirator, I was charged the same way. And in that 5 years, because of my age, I was sent to like a youth facility, which was Bordentown at that time. And once I got a certain size, and they transferred me to a larger facility, which was Rahway State Prison, who in turn released me. Once they released me in the early 90s, 93, I was home. At that point in my life, I had decided that my whole life was changed. I was never going back. I had got a good job. I was working at Quail's Menswear up in Willowbrook Mall. I was an excellent salesman for them, paying me pretty good money. Got a nice apartment up in Montclair, New Jersey. Got custody of my son, who I felt was the change in my life as well, who had left before I was incarcerated. His mother was pregnant, so I wasn't even there to witness his birth. So that was a big part of me coming home as a changed man to take responsibility of my son. Got me a nice car and everything, and I was doing pretty well. And as a result of doing that, I was picked up and identified as someone who committed another offense, saying a warrant was out for my arrest, saying that you've been identified as a person who committed a sexual-related offense and a kidnap. And against my adamant denial, like, listen, it's not me. I didn't do this. I didn't even do that before. But now they had me in custody. Once they arrested me and put me in custody, the threat of we can hold you and keep you here for the rest of your life was real to me. They had shown me that they had the power to do that already.
Oh, yeah. You were in a very precarious situation. I mean, 7 years had gone by. Your life was, as you said, your life was on track.
Yeah.
Things are looking good. And then this crazy thing happens. And then a lot of weird stuff goes on. I mean, a lot of lying, a lot of cheating the system because they really wanted to convict you. In your case, it doesn't seem like they were really that interested in finding out who raped this woman.
Right.
They were interested in pinning it on you.
Right.
Just because they had you, and we've seen that part of this scenario happen before. That's not the craziest thing about your story. I mean, it's crazy because it happened to you, but it's not uncommon, unfortunately.
Right.
But things get really crazy as we go along. Well, take us through this, right?
Well, once I was in custody, it was really my public defender, as they say in jailhouse term, my public pretender, who came and said to me, in this theatrical way that he had convinced me that the state had this overwhelming evidence that the witness was outside. By the way, this is my third attorney public defender within a 4-month period. And that he said the witness seen my photo and start crying uncontrollably. And they had pinpointed me and that if I was going to go to trial, I was going to be in jail for the rest of my life. Now, at that point, I felt so overwhelmed backtracking what just happened to me earlier at 17. They said, well, look, we're going to offer you a plea agreement. We're going to give you a 7-year term, and you're going to do 2 years, and you'll come home. If you just plead guilty, we're going to dismiss the sexual related offense, and you would downgrade the kidnap to second degree and put on record no one got hurt. And so in my mind, I thought I would save my life because I had just left my son out there, and I didn't know what was going on. I was separated from my family. So I took the plea agreement, and I entered a plea to a crime I didn't commit. In doing that, I felt like I had betrayed myself in a way that it took me years to get over. In the process of that, I was sent down to state prison to do the 7-year term because I went to parole. And parole actually was saying that, oh, well, listen, you're here not just for the kidnap, but we're here for what the police reports are saying, for the sexual offense. And I was like, no, I didn't do any of that. I didn't do any of it. At this point, I'm like, I didn't do any. I just pled guilty thinking, trying to save my life. Well, that sent them in a spiral. Like, I was in denial, and then I showed no remorse, which I couldn't show remorse for something I did not do, and that's what I was trying to explain to them. But as a result of that, I was denied parole maybe 3 times, and then I was maxed out. And in being maxed out, that means I served a full 7-year term as opposed to 2-year term. But before you are released from prison, you are sent to these parole classes. So I went to the parole classes and the pre-release classes, which I did stellar in because I'm thinking I'm going home. And so on the day of my release, I was brought out to the front like every other prisoner who was scheduled to be released that day, lined up. But instead, when they called everyone's name, they didn't call mine. So they had released all of them and left me standing there. And the day of the day I had maxed out means that I had no more time left to do.
But so you're there, you have your possessions, whatever your possessions were that you had in prison with you, you had them with you, right? You're ready to go home, start your life again.
Right.
See your son, reestablish your relationships
right.
with your family, the whole thing.
They were actually in the parking lot waiting to take me home.
And go get something to eat.
Yeah,
whatever.
We had it all arranged. And I mean, I had, grown into more after 7 years from this experience. In a degree where I felt like now my life is really going to be, I'll take control of my life and really do it right. But as opposed to being released, I was held and transferred to what New Jersey called to a special treatment unit. Because I refused to plead guilty or admit my role in the sexual-related offense, New Jersey had passed a law called the Sexual Violent Predator Act, which said that if they felt like a person was still dangerous, that they could not be released. So they civilly committed me under that pretense. So I was taken to a facility, civil commitment facility, which is like a civil commitment, like traditional. However, this was like a new hybrid facility that New Jersey had came up with, where they combined the Department of Correction and Department of Human Service to there. Department of Human Service there would provide treatment to those that were committed. And I was held there for 10 years.
It's unreal. I mean, 10 years on top. It's like, I think most people are listening and going, wait, that doesn't make sense. You can't serve your sentence and then serve another sentence that you didn't even have, which is longer by 50% than your original sentence was in the first place. And you know, it's so crazy, right? You plead innocent, they send you to prison, and you plead guilty, they send you home,
right?
It's so backwards. It's like Alice in Wonderland. But in your case, that's literally what happened. They wanted you to acknowledge your guilt. I mean, they pulled the rug out from under you so many different times in so many different ways by now, right? They had lied to you about the witness who actually had not identified you and never did identify you, right? And they had told you that she did. You know, when you talk about 3 public defenders in 4 months, I mean, it's not hard for anyone to imagine how little your public defender must have known about your case when they keep switching them out.
Right.
Like, there's just not that much time to get to understand what's going on. And to be fair, these people are, even the best ones of them, are juggling a lot of cases because that's just the way the system works. He or she might have been working on 100 cases at that time.
And that came out that down the line, the attorney admitted that when he had like 40 cases, clients in a bullpen, which is the holding area for prisoners, he had an overwhelming caseload and like 40 were there. And by the time he got to me, he was in a ceiling line mode. But in the process of being civilly committed, that whole experience within itself was a crazy experience, because it is an experience that you could be civilly committed without a conviction. Now, you're not convicted. Everything is done through medical terms. This is, you know, saying you have a psychiatrist and a psychologist who come in and say, I read the record and we think his person is guilty, and, you know, and then that becomes, you're guilty, and that becomes the reason they hold you. There's no justice there whatsoever. There's no trial. There's no way. They give you a hearing that the attorney general totally dictates. So there's no way to challenge the whole process of it, because the psychiatrists work for the state. They come in, they write whatever the attorney general wants them to say. In my particular case, that was one beneficial point feature that I always like to add, was the state sent a psychiatrist in to interview me. And as a result of his interview, he changed his mind, became my witness, and testified that I should have been released. As a result, they diminished him. He was later released, but he jumped ship. But in that process, they assigned me an attorney, another public defender named John DeWard, who I owe utmost respect for, in their office. And I explained to him, I said, listen, this was in 2004. I said, listen, I pled guilty to a crime I didn't commit. Listen, I shouldn't be here. And I explained to him what happened. And I said, listen, I pled guilty because I was in fear of my life. I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in jail. I wanted to be home with my family. He said, listen, I'm going to take a chance with you. So what he did was, him and his investigator, they went and found the victim. And they went and interviewed her. And they showed her my photo. And she asked, well, did you know this guy? She says, I never seen this guy there in my life. They were like, wait a minute, this guy's locked up for a crime against you. She didn't even know anyone was locked up, particularly me. She said, I didn't ever identify him. That sent my case into a spiral. As a result of that, she gave a sworn statement. We thought that that was going to be enough to have me released from civil commitment.
It would seem like that would be enough. Yeah. I'm sure, again, everyone listening is going, okay, well, that's it. Go home. You're done now. But that's not the way it worked. But I want to make one more point before we get into the next part of the story, which is that 95% of state felony convictions are a result of guilty pleas.
Right?
Because almost anyone faced with your situation, especially someone who had already had experience of how heavy the criminal justice system can come down on you, given a choice between what they were telling you was going to be 2 years or 28 months or whatever it was, or the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, try to walk a mile in those shoes, right?
And that's a horrible statistic.
It's a horrible statistic. Yeah. And like I said, it may not seem like it affects you, but someday it could. I mean, it could affect you or someone you love. Anyone who's listening right now, you know, your chance with a public defender, the odds are too stacked.
They form what would be a trifecta. Judge, the prosecutor, and public defender, in my mind, like a collaboration to coerce me into this plea agreement, to make it as if that was my only result to save my life.
But here's what's so crazy about your case, Ronnie, is that, first of all, start with you were innocent. Second of all, the idea that your own attorney says you're going to get 2 years, but you end up getting 7 years.
Right.
But then they turn that into 17 years.
Right.
How can that be that your own people let you down to that extent? The system too,
right,
but your own people. And then the other thing, like I said, that I really want to highlight, because we haven't covered this on the show yet, but it's a reality, and it's a crazy reality that most people don't focus on, is this idea of civil commitment.
Right.
And that sounds, civil commitment sounds like a relatively benign term, but it was hell in there. I heard you talk about it.
It was horrible in there. I mean, it was horrible in the fact that I was exposed to an element that I had never have been exposed to before, a mindset. The danger is real. There's a need to protect the most vulnerable members of our society. That's real. However, the process of selection is flawed. Now, when I say it's flawed, if they see that you don't fit that criteria, you don't have what they call a present danger, you don't have the mental incapacity or the repetitive or compulsive personality, you should not be there. Now, in that environment, you hear things and stories that are so horrible that makes you, like, I used to cry in some of the groups, but because I didn't fit in any mold, I had no diagnosis, because I wasn't able to be put in any group. So I was separated from the population and put in isolation. I spent most of my time, maybe 9 years, in isolation away from the population. But the big part of that case was, for years, we asked the state for the kits, what they said that they had to show the DNA evidence. They said they lost it.
Let's go back to that. And before we even do, I want to make that point, too, because I think you and I are on the same page, because I often say that I'm not soft on crime. I'm tough on injustice, right?
Exactly.
And I think, too, anybody who, you know, who hurts another human being, we have to have a society of laws. We have to protect the general population. I do believe what Bryan Stevenson says, which is that everybody's better than the worst thing they've ever done.
Yeah.
But that being said, we have to hold people accountable. We have to be safe as a society. But we also have to be fair, and everyone's entitled to a fair shake and to a fair trial and to fair treatment by the system. And you are the poster child, for lack of a better word, of everything that's wrong and everything that can go wrong. Mm-hmm. And I want to get back to the rape kits, because as you said, as your lawyers were trying to get the rape kits, they were saying, and we've seen this before, that they lost them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't lose them, but they said they lost them. Either they were too lazy to look for them, or they didn't look very hard, or whatever it was, or they were hiding them. Who knows? But one way or another, that was one of the things that kept you in as long as it did, because had they found those rape kits, you would have been freed, because it would have proven that you could not have been the source of the semen that was found inside this woman. But talk a little bit about this isolation, right? What was that like, the isolation? I mean, does that mean you were in like solitary confinement type of cell?
Yeah, I was in, it had a special unit called a B unit, where these particular individuals, either they were treatment refusers, either they refused to even participate in any programming, or like myself, had no diagnosis. And one other feature was they felt that I had too much influence on the population in regards to my legal skill, my ability to advocate. When I would stand up and say, this is an injustice, this is not right, I had no idea how many people was behind me saying, yeah, what he said. So I was always looked at as someone citing riots or creating gatherings, because all I was doing was standing up for what I thought was my rights. So as a result, the administration decided to isolate me and put me in isolation, so I could not... I was only able to go to visits with the rest of the population. I wasn't able to go groups, programs, events. I couldn't participate in anything because of my stance and because I would not admit guilt. At this point, I stood firmly that I'm innocent. And that also set me apart from the population, because the only way you could get therapy and treatment is you had to admit guilt. And in this isolation, you were put on this unit. And this unit is, I mean, one of the most miserable places you could be, because this is a unit of hopelessness. You feel like you're forgot about, left there. You feel like everything at this point in your life is over, that no one believes you, and that the fight is so uphill. It's like ice skating uphill. I mean, and in that moment, you know, I grew to a point where, as though, I said to myself, because they would constantly say, fortunately, had COs, they had correction officers there, and they had correction officers there who's, you know, he was very understanding. So he would say, lock in. You know, you gotta lock in your cell, which no one wants to go be locked in a cell. But he was cordial about it. He did his job, but he wasn't really arrogant about it or aggressive. He would say, lock in, guys. So everybody would feel more easy about doing it. But this particular day, he wasn't there. And they had this officer on, and he was just being extra unnecessary that day, all that day. And so when time came for us to lock in, he said, lock in. And the way he said it resonated in me so deeply. He said, lock in. I said to myself, no. Yeah, no, I'm not locking it. No, I'm not. I'm innocent. I'm not going in that room. I'm not supposed to be here today. So he says, if you don't lock in, I'm going to have to call the boys. It's going to be trouble. I said, well, it's going to be some trouble today. The day is that day. We're going to have some trouble up here. It's going to be some trouble. So he called the boys. So I'm up there back and forth. I'm ready. I'm positioning myself. Yeah, it's going down today. I'm tired of this. I'm not locking it no more. I'm innocent. So they ran up the stairs, and I'm ready for them. They come running, like 8, 9 up. They ready to get me. So when they got to the top of the stairs, I rushed them. I grabbed them. And like for 3 seconds, I was the man. After that 3 seconds, I was that guy. After that 3 seconds, I felt my feet come off the ground. I felt my arm being pulled back around me. But they felt, they threw me, grabbed me, and threw me in my cell. But you know what? I was in my cell. I was standing in my cell. I brushed myself off, and I was like, yeah, that 3 seconds. Yeah, at least I stood up for 3 seconds. And I lived in that 3 second moment for years. But as a result of standing up and feeling that in that 3 seconds, they looked at me different in the population. They said, well, Why would someone put themselves through that? Why would someone stand up against 8, 9 different people just to say they're innocent? And that's made them take a step back and say, let's look at this guy again. And as a result, they became more lenient against me, allowed me to more access to the law library, allowed me to move around a little bit more quietly. They would say, listen, we like you. We like how you move, but don't make us choose between you and our job, because I'm going to choose my job. And if I got a knock in your head, I'm knocking your head. So I had to learn how to maneuver within that philosophy. And that gave me the room I needed to litigate harder, fight harder for my freedom. And that 3 seconds, I live in this very moment, because in that 3 seconds, I was the champion that I needed to be. It liberated me. It was only 3 seconds it took him for my whole life in that moment to liberate me to be the man I am today and grow and feel strong. Now I had the rest of my life. 3 seconds turned into the rest of my life. Then that changed everything for me.
You literally risked your life. I mean, here comes these guys with the shields and the helmets and the batons. And they might have killed you, and nobody would have prosecuted him if they did.
Exactly.
They would have said, he rushed us.
Right, he came at us.
He was dangerous. Right. We risked our life, blah, blah, blah. So you became the man in that moment, which was really a spontaneous reaction, right? Mm-hmm.
Because for me, that moment right there reflected in my mind that I had enough.
Well, because the thing is, and I keep coming back to this, right? On top of the wrongful conviction, on top of the rug being pulled out from under you with the 2 years, you know, which you had to plead guilty, something you didn't do, then the 7 years, and then really the terrifying idea of you not being able to go home and everybody else going home.
Exactly.
And then the idea that you're in there for 10 years, and it's an indefinite sentence.
Yes.
It's not even like if they sentence you, well, we're going to put you in this confinement thing for 10 years.
Right.
At least you would know at the end of 10 years you're going home. But you had no idea when you were going home. They could have kept you there forever.
And because I was saying I'm innocent, that totally took me out the running. That disqualified any opportunity for my release. If it wasn't for the fact that the appellate court finally got tired, they reversed my case 3 times. But on the 3rd time, they finally were so frustrated that they reassigned me a new attorney and a new judge. And then, mysteriously, the evidence that we were looking for appears. That we were asking for maybe 10 years, a 9.5, 10 years, that they said was lost, pops out of nowhere. Well, we mislabeled. Here we go. And it was
mislabeled this.
Exactly.
But this is another thing it still strikes me as nutty that, and that's not a strong enough word, the idea that your conviction was overturned 3 times, mm-hmm. right? And these were pro se motions that you were filing. A pro se motion, for people who haven't heard that term before, means a motion filed by an inmate on their own behalf without the benefit of a lawyer. So how does it happen that you get these convictions? And it could, again, talk about more rugs being pulled out from under you, right? Here you are. Like, they're going dangling you around like a marionette, right? So you get this overturned, and then they don't free you anyway. Right. And then they do it again, and then they don't free you anyway. And then finally it takes a judge to go, I'm tired of this shit, right?
Right.
I'm tired. He was tired. Imagine how tired you must have been.
See, people,
I'm tired from listening to the damn story.
I know. And, you know, a lot of people don't really take into account how something of this magnitude affects someone, especially me. I mean, personally for me, how much all this, even from 17 all the way up to this point, what I had to deal with as a person, as a young man, and to deal with this environment and to deal with the pain and separation and all. I was separated from my family and had the hostility of the environment I had to survive in and keep my head together and hold on to hope. Because, you know, that was, you know, it was times I had to deal with a lot of depression. It was times I had to fight off, you know, saying a feeling that this was never going to end. I was always going to be in a situation that I was never going to be able to prove to anyone that I'm worthy or someone to value me. I mean, it was so hard, you know, saying, and dealing with disappointment over and over again. I used to ask myself, am I addicted to disappointment? Because it started becoming to the point where I started becoming desensitized. Like, I expected to be let down. It affected me in a way where, as though I felt that God had to be watching over me, because the fact that, you know, I'm not crazy at this point because of the experience of having to fight off all these emotions of loneliness and the emotion of feeling powerless and just disenfranchised and all these feelings I lived with for years.
Can you just give us some insight into what was the worst and the best experience you had during your 17 years locked up in the miserable conditions that you were in?
The worst experience was being placed in a position to have to plead guilty to a crime I didn't commit, along with being civilly committed in a facility where the stigma was horrible and have to live under the stigma of in that environment and survive in that such high stigma of being looked at and as someone who has those characteristics, even though I didn't. The happiest moment that I had, that kind of nullified, kind of takes and put all that in this perspective, was in the courtroom when the judge finally, Judge Sherry Hutchins Henderson, when she finally got the DNA evidence she needed from the state lab, and she said to me, Mr. Robinson, she apologized. And her apology was so heartfelt of how she felt so bad that this happened to me. But when she said, I'm reversing your conviction, my support system was like maybe 13 people, my niece, my sister, my lady, my mother, my friends. They bust out in like jubilation. And it was so loud in the courtroom. You know, they was out there like they was having the Holy Ghost back there, like church was going on. And the judge, she allowed them to have that moment because that was their moment of vindication as well as mine, because they believed me. They stood by me all those years, and we knew it. And, you know, I was expecting to turn around, see them roll on the floor. But in that moment, I cried. I felt vindicated. I felt now, you know, I was happy. I felt like something in my life just turned around. And in that moment, you know, hearing them cheering and empowered me. And I think I, you know, it changed my whole walk at that point, because I went back, and because I had to go back to the civil commitment facility to be released from there. But I had that George Jefferson walk, you know what I'm saying?
Oh my God.
I'm walking on like George Jefferson now, you know, so.
And moving on.
Yeah. So I was there. So that experience right there was the happiest moment of my life. And, you know, that courtroom experience, I just cannot ever erase that from my mind and heart. How wrong that made me feel when the judge said that, and hear my family and everyone that loved me was just so happy to hear it and to know they was right, because they went through a lot of turmoil and come to visit and being discriminated against and coming inside and looked down upon, like, you supporting this guy and that kind of, with this kind of person with this kind of charge, and they had to go through all that and endure, and now to find and see that they were right and had that moment where they were like elated. And so that moment, like I said, gave me that George Jefferson confidence. I was walking back, everybody looking at me like I was a new guy. Like, look at this guy. Who is this guy here? So.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. And yeah, obviously no one can understand that feeling that hasn't been through it, but you're painting a very vivid picture, mm-hmm. and making, I'm sure, everyone that's listening feel that the little piece of that joy that you had,
yeah.
and that vindication and that feeling.
Yeah.
When you were enduring, and it's so crazy, I was just thinking about the timeline of your life, right? 17 years, then 5 years in prison, then 7 years out, then 17 years. It's really a crazy roller coaster ride that's impossible for anyone to understand who hasn't lived it. And it's sort of a miracle that you're here, and it's really inspiring just to hear you talk and see the way you are. So I want to ask you, when you were locked up, was there any particular person that gave you hope, that gave you strength?
Yeah. At that time, I had a support system. Her name was Linda Roberts at this point. She was very strong in my life then. I have a strong support system now since I've been home. With her name is Talita James. We call her Della. So there was an adjustment process. But the one person who kept me moving, when I was 17, the judge asked me, and this is on the record, the judge said before he sentenced me, because I was scheduled to be sentenced to a higher sentence. But he asked me, he said, is there anything you want to say, young man? So I turned to my mother, who was crying, and who I was hurting so bad because I'm her youngest son. And she just knew that this was wrong. And I said to my mother, I said, no matter what, I'm not going to let this destroy me. I'm going to do the best I could. I'm sorry. And then I'm going to hold on. And I talked to my mother in the courtroom. And everyone was amazed to see me and my mother at this time having this back and forth discussion, because she was saying, hold on, I'll just keep in prayer. And in the courtroom, and that conversation has been my mantra for all these years, to tell my mother,
know that no matter what she instilled in me as her son and my father, but my mother, what she put in me, was nothing was ever going to tear that down. And that moral compass that she instilled in me to find my way back to right is never going to be taken out. And that has been my rock, my mother. She continues to be, and she will always be, that one moral compass. She is my North Star.
Sounds like an extraordinary woman.
She's 85, and you can't tell her she's not 50. But
that's hilarious.
And I love her, and she's my strength, and she knows she is, and I just cannot get enough of her. So I adore her, and she knows it.
It's so important, and you just heard from Rodney, that connection remains intact between families, so between loved ones and people who are incarcerated.
Right.
And, you know, in this country, we have such a crazy system where inmates are charged, incarcerated people are charged 5 to 10 times as much for collect calls, which is insane. Now they're moving away from in-person visits in certain states where they're changing it to where you're going to get an iPad and you get to talk to your family members on the iPad. And it's like, I mean, we're going in the wrong direction. In a lot of ways, the criminal justice system is being reformed in good ways now. But in that way, it just doesn't make any sense, because we just heard it directly from you. It's so important to maintain that, to keep that hope alive and to keep that connection strong, not just for you, but for your children or your mother or whatever relatives are on the outside that love you and care about you. So while you were locked up the second time, were you able to maintain a relationship with your son? And how is that now?
Well, my son is an amazing young man. Even what he's been through and with me out of his life, he's grown to be a very strong young man. He's maybe 6'5", maybe 290. You know, he's a big guy. You know what I'm saying? Very mild mannered, very religious. Never been involved in the law. You know, doesn't drink or hang out or anything. Works, goes to church. I love who he's become. During my time, his absence, one thing that we always had that kept us together was we had a passion for reading. I taught him how to read, basically, and he would get on the phone and he would read to me. And actually, speaking, we learned how to read together through comic books. I would buy comic books and I would buy him one, and I'd buy me one, and I would read it and he would read it, and we would talk about the comic books. And that's how we develop our relationship through reading. And to this day, we still talk about comic books. We're both so amazed at the new Marvel movies. We run to see them together because we read about them all his life, and me all my life, really.
And you have a lady in your life now?
Yes, I do. A beautiful young lady who has been patient with me, even in all my adjustment. And Talita James, Della James, who has dealt with the ups and downs of myself and herself. And we've struggled together. And I appreciate everything she's done for me and with me and to me. It helped me become a stronger man in my adjustment process.
Rodney's a sharp-dressed guy. I was complimenting him before on his shoes. He's got a nice, beautiful, crisp white shirt. And told me the credit belongs to her, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't even pick my own clothes. I go in a store and I pick something up and she ignores it. So because I came home, I was like 290 myself in weight. He helped me even in my healthier eating, you know, working out. I mean, there has been an adjustment process with her there in my life. And I only pray that I contributed something strong to her life through my strength brings to her, that makes her know that there's always a resilience and that you could come back from anything. Just, you know, saying nothing that's overwhelming in life that you can't start all over and be strong through. So I'm hoping that my experiences and her seeing me, what I've been through, and still being a strong enough man to make her want to love me has contributed to her life as well. And with that, you know, I have 6 sisters. One passed away, my younger sister, Sharon, but there as well. And they're like parole officers. I have to check in with them. And if I don't check in with them, there's a...
the price to pay.
Yeah, so I have some strong, beautiful women in my life that really supervise me, so to speak, and take care of me and help me along the way. And I think it's made me a much stronger man and much confident man as well. I came home this time, and I was blessed to come home this time. And I said to myself, I'm able to talk about these feelings, but feeling them at the moment was like so sad for me. I used to have moments where I would be sad for like days. And I'd be like, pull myself out. You got to pull yourself out of this. I used to have to coach myself and give myself pep talks over and over. Come on, man. People was like, you over there talking to yourself again? I'm like, listen, this is the best conversation I've had all day. And, you know, to pull myself out of states of where I just felt like it was so much overwhelming, you know. I really can't begin to tell all the year, because we're talking about since 17 and then now, and how much suffering it felt like. I mean, I feel, that's why today I advocate, because I can identify with suffering. You know, I don't like to see anything suffer, and that's from animals to people to plants to anything, because I know what it feels like to suffer. I know what it feels like to be put in a position to, that, you know, where you just hurting inside emotionally and psychologically, that you just want some help from somewhere, you know. And that's why I stand today, because I just want to be that for someone who may feel hopeless and feel like there's no one, and maybe they see me and they say, you know, this guy, you know, it's just someone out there that understands and cares, because I felt there was no one. As a result, now I just started the Rodney Roberts Foundation.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about that.
What I offer is the one thing that most individuals who have been wrongfully convicted, not just wrongfully convicted, but particularly the wrongfully convicted, but individuals who've come home and feel as there's no one to connect with. Because in the wrongful conviction community, the one thing we don't have, no state has an agency that provides housing, work assistance, counseling. No state has that. So you like come home and there's nowhere for you to turn, because some states maybe feel they don't want to make that. So you have nowhere to go to. So you have no opportunities there. Myself, when I came home, I had to compete with my counterparts, with guys on parole, probation, for jobs and training and treatment. And I'm going in and saying, look, I'm innocent. I was just exonerated. And employees was like, listen, hey, man, that's a great story. We did, but we're in a money-making business, and we'd rather hire that guy on parole because we get tax deductions for
wow.
And he got, one employee told me, he's like, well, I get tax deductions for hiring guys on parole. He was like, you're a great guy. I'm sorry what happened to you, but I had to hire this guy. Plus, you've been gone 17 years, so we don't know anything. So I was left in the void. And so I had to literally create a job for myself. I had to literally create an opportunity for myself by taking that frustration, that of being denied, have no place to fit in, and taking the passion that I have to advocate against this injustice of prosecutorial misconduct and ineffective counsel and coerced plea agreements. And I start talking about it on a basis where people start listening and saying, you know what? We like what he's saying, because he's relevant, is right on time, and we think that needs to be heard. And I was brought into like organizations like the Innocent Project, who would give me assignments and say, Rodney, go, you work with us and speak here. We can help you with a little compensation here. And that grew into me working closely with them and me making the commercials with them and me doing other work with them. And Jeffrey Deskrick had the Jeffrey Deskrick Foundation, brought me in and helped me, school me in a way where, you know, this is what you need to be saying, and this is how you should present, and this is, we're going to give you this little space here. So the Rodney Roberts Foundation is a representation of all that experience. What I want to do is I want to give an opportunity for those who have been wrongfully convicted to be able to reach out, that's currently incarcerated, to reach out. Someone in New Jersey, because New Jersey is far behind in everything when it comes to wrongful convicted. Even currently, saying legislation is being challenged now. But I want to be that to help with job placement, help find housing, help with counseling, which is most important, which even myself, after all these years, is an important feature even for myself, to help with counseling, to help with reconnecting those with their families, because the one group that suffers the most in most situations is the family. They see the person locked up, but once a family member is locked up, the whole family is basically locked up in a certain degree, because they can't stop being connected with their loved one. So they suffer as well. And the families have to also be educated on what's necessary to help this person reintegrate, and what's to look for, and what characteristics to look for when you see a person slip in, or what leads to recidivism, and what when you see signs of depression or feeling hopeless. So the Rodney Roberts Foundation has multifacets in that level, and also with the public speaking aspect as well. Right now, I have the Rodney Roberts Foundation. I have a GoFundMe account that I'm trying to raise money now to create a platform to bring people in, get a staff. That's my goal, is to have a staff in a permanent location, an office in New Jersey, where And I'm growing from there. I have my email set up, Rodney Roberts Foundation 96 at gmail.com. And also in the Rodney Roberts Foundation, what we're going to do also, we're going to collaborate with other organizations to fight against wrongful convictions, prosecutorial misconduct, ineffective counsel. We're going to, you know, try to grow in that degree. Right now, I don't want to put the buggy before the horse because I'm not elevated to that level yet to be as prestigious as some of the organizations that are there. But hold on, because I'm on my way. I'm headed in the right direction, and with the passion and ideas and
energy, and, you got a lot of energy, man. I'm
headed there, and I'm gonna build and have some wins so everyone in New Jersey and worldwide can connect to also.
And that's really exciting that you're doing that. I think you're gonna make a big difference in a lot of people's lives. What can people do? Obviously, I hope people will support, join me in supporting, because I'm gonna support you in the Rodney Roberts Foundation. But what else can people do?
Well, I think particularly if their loved one is involved, how close they are, if it's a family member that you're directly related to or close with, the first thing you need to reach out to their attorney. Find out who their attorney is, who's representing them, and get their discoveries. Get whatever paperwork, whatever documents they have. Get familiar with what the record says yourself and try to understand that. Because the first thing you have to do is educate yourself, because most time we rely on hearsay, what this attorney says or this person says, and that could be misleading. If you are in a position to find out yourself, you could read through their paperwork, their discoveries, and decipher what's being said, or did not help the family member understand exactly what's being charged and how to approach the situation. Secondly, just a visit, a card, a letter. At some point, take some time out to show that person that they're not forgotten, and that strengthens the person. You don't know how much it feels good to sit there and then hear when they do a mail call and you're waiting and you hear everybody else's name call and your name not call over and over. Then one day you hear your name. Oh, you run to get this letter because now you know someone out there has reached back inside. So even that, something as simple as that is major to some. And understand that when a person is released and they come home, they're going through a sort of a culture shock or a reverse culture shock. They're going through a process where they're released from one environment to another. And this change, they have to unlearn what they just learned, you know, and to relearn what they already knew about how to interact in society. You're talking about a person who just went through a prison experience and where they had to be in a controlled environment where they had to stand in line and eat and had eaten a certain period of time. And, you know, these things are built into you when you do the same repetitive thing over and over again, become institutionalized. Now you had to come home into a new environment and the shock of that, which is, you know, just culture shock, because to unlearn all this and then to readjust yourself back to being free. Understand that that process is not as easy. You know, even if the person makes it look easy, it's not easy. There's a pretend there, because this affects anyone that's been locked up in a long period of time. So make sure you give them enough cushion so that they can have those moments, well, which you may see, like myself, you know, when I first came home, because in the prison, you go to take a shower, your underwear and you wash. So I went home, came home, I went and showered my underwear, and the lady was like, "What are you doing?" So, and I was like, "Oh, I went wash." She was like, "Listen, you're not there anymore, so you don't." So so you gotta look for little sounds like that where they're sitting at the table and they take their spoon and put it inside the cup, and you're like, "What are you doing?" You know, it's the little jailhouse things that people have to shed and little psychological things that people may do. Have a little more patience with the loved one.
I want to reinforce one point that you made, which is so powerful, and I'm glad you said it, which is that it's so important that people understand that just because your loved one or even you have a lawyer doesn't mean that lawyer is doing a great job.
Right.
Even the best intentions sometimes in the court system, which we know is not always the best intentions, right, but mistakes are made. So even if you have a good defense lawyer, they might be going through something in their life. They might miss a detail. So if you have that opportunity to be able to read those papers and those transcripts, you might be able to find that piece of evidence or that legal principle that might help yourself or your loved one.
Right.
And you can present that to your lawyer and they may have missed it. And so that's such a great point that you brought up. And now, Ronnie, we have a tradition on wrongful conviction. which is that I like to just sit here and listen and let you talk about anything you think you may have left out. You know, you got so much knowledge and so much heart and so much to share. So I just want to give you a chance to just say anything at all that you want.
Wow. At this point, you know, even given that opportunity, I once read that it says that AMR, a person who's been through hell and came out, but takes buckets of water back to those who are there. And even this moment, I still want to hold dear to my passion to try to reach out to others as well. And at this point, through the Rodney Roberts Foundation, I'm just trying to buy a bigger bucket. Because I went back, I took buckets there, and I found out that my buckets need to be a little bit bigger to provide more service to a larger group of people. And just that, you know, I want to continue to stay close to the front line and stay close to, you know, fighting alongside the champions such as yourself and others and trying to expose something in this country that has become a phenomenon now as wide as wrongful conviction and prosecutorial misconduct and ineffective counsel. And continue to be on a positive path and a productive path and so I can make myself and my mother and my loved ones proud of me and proud to be associated with me. So that's it for me.
Well, for anyone who's listening, you've now heard the extraordinary saga and the equally extraordinary spirit of Rodney Roberts. I hope you'll consider donating to the Rodney Roberts Foundation. For every dollar that anyone donates, myself and Wrongful Conviction, we will match up to $10,000. So we'll get you off to a good start there. And we'll be very proud to continue to support you as you do this amazing life-saving work. And I'm just really, I'm just proud to know you and happy to call you a friend. And I appreciate you coming on and sharing your experience, strength, and wisdom with our audience. And I want to thank you again, Rodney. And you've been listening to a very unique and tremendous episode of Wrongful Conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.